Am I asleep now, awake, or what?
I realize I don't look so hot, David. But I thought you'd be glad to see me. David, you're hurting my feelings.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, if you're listening in the United States. Good afternoon, good evening, if you're in the UK and beyond. I'm Beau Ransdell. This is Horror Hangover. Who knew there would be another? Thanks for listening. This is, of course, the Legion Podcast's exclusive podcast. There is no other way to get this other than to subscribe to the Legion Podcast's feed. So thanks for doing that. Hey, you guys are great. I appreciate it, and so do the other hosts. So let's talk a little bit. Speaking of Legion podcasts, let's talk a little bit about what's going on around the old Legion podcasts network coming up in the next few days here. We have a couple of notes here from the hosts to point out some things. Darren Wilson over at Psychosomatic Podcast, they're about to have their 1 year anniversary. So he axes everyone to drop a line if you're a listener to that show, and let them know what you thought of the first year of the Psychosomatic Podcast. I appeared on that show my own self and enjoyed myself quite a bit. I don't get to talk politics too much. It's off-putting to some people, and yeah, it was a good time. We talked about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that Philip Kaufman remake, which is outstanding and surprisingly and frighteningly relevant to today's society. At any rate, so shoot him a message over at psychosemanticast@gmail.com. That is psychosemanticast@gmail.com, Psychosemanticast. Cinema PsyOps, speaking of Darren Wilson, also doing good things over there. They're about to drop an episode where Darren Wilson hops over to the Cinema PsyOps to talk about the movie Fido, which is a really great movie. And there is a sort of a Japanese analog to that film I've been trying to get my hands on. At any rate, over at the VD Clinic, that's David Anders and Vanessa McHenry. They are doing Hebrew Hammer for the holiday episode, so that'll be coming soon. The Kiss the Goat Holiday Extravaganza is coming out, courtesy of X and Cootie. And he says that's going to be filled with holiday stories, special music, and a listener-requested look at the Christmas classic, The Mothman Prophecies. Yes, I remember being a young child, wee lad, gathering around the television to watch Mothman Prophecies. And it taught us humility, is what it taught us. And that's a good holiday, if you learn a little of that. Latest Witch versus the Doomsday Clock, courtesy of the witch himself, finishes off the Scottish Nazi storyline, and he's going to be putting out three soundtracks to Doomsday episodes over the break with music from the show. And I have said it before, I will say it again, the Witch versus the Doomsday Clock is a super weird show that everyone should listen to, and it is almost beyond description. You just have to kind of give it a listen. And it's amazing because those episodes don't tend to be very long, but they're dense. They're packed with stuff. So give that a listen. Plenty more going on, you know, podcast under the stairs, always doing some new stuff. And I think, there is a Fright Night, episode coming with the Baz, which I'm really looking forward to. At any rate, so that's all the stuff coming up, on the legionpodcasts.com. Thank you again for subscribing and for listening to their shows. And if you haven't listened to some of those, all the ones I mentioned there, I, you know, wholeheartedly, unreservedly recommend to you. So the holidays are upon us. Which means that, you know, there's some irregular schedules going on with the shows and whatnot, so bear with us through all of that. There should be new Devour coming out before end of the month, but, you know, time is fleeting. We'll see how all that goes. Yeah, so, you know, keep an eye out if you see, like, your favorite shows aren't out exactly when you expect them to be, then, you know, bear with us. It's a holiday. You know how it is. I don't have to tell you, listeners. You're good people. You know how this goes. Okay, so Horror Hangover. We did, you know, a handful of episodes. It was kind of a roundtable show. And I quickly realized that that was untenable. There was just no way we were going to get on a weekly basis a group of people together from various podcasts because they're all doing their own shows and have their own lives and yada yada. So that turned out not to be a great idea. But I like the title, and I wanted to do something like this that was an exclusive show. I kind of sat on it for a while, thought about it, and so what we're going to do is we are going to kind of catch up with the network, as we just did. And then we're going to talk about a movie that I think is worth your time, a good weekend movie for one reason or the other. We are going to lump these into two categories, the first of which will be entitled Comfort Food. The Horror Hangover, I'm a little hungover myself, apparently. Horror Hangover Comfort Food. And that's where we're going to start. And then there's going to be the bad version of that, right? Comfort food is like, hey, you got yourself a little tickle in the noggin because you were out drinking the night before. This is a good movie to kick back and just let wash over you. Then there's going to be the awful movie version of that. I don't have a title yet, so... couple of things I may call upon the listeners for here, and that is both an intro to the show, which I have not yet cobbled together, and maybe even some show art. I don't know. But also just some ideas of what you want to hear. You can contact me at boo@legionpodcasts.com or head over to the Facebook page, Legion Podcasts, and from there, drop me a message and let me know what you like, what you don't like. You know, obviously we want the show to be enjoyable to listeners. We're going to get into kind of weird, obscure films that I like, or really don't like, for one reason or another, but I'm also obsessed with. So I wanted to tread a little off the beaten path. You're not going to see like a Friday the 13th or something pop up, on this show. It's going to be more about, movies that, you got to go out of your way to find. And in this case, the movie we're going to be talking about today, you couldn't even see the original ending to this thing until the, year of our Lord 2012. So yeah, the movie, without, hiding that too long, and it'll be on the show art, so I don't know what's a big mystery. The movie is Phase 4. Which is another Nature Gone Amok movie, and I love those. And it's the only feature that a gentleman named Saul Bass ever directed. And we'll get into that. So, in fact, let's do that. So, Phase 4 was written by a guy named Mayo Simon, who also wrote the screenplay for Future World, the sequel to Westworld. Kind of a heady science fiction guy, also did a movie called Marooned. Created the show The Man from Atlantis, starring Patrick Duffy, and wrote a bunch of those episodes. And The Man from Atlantis was a strange show. At any rate, the director of the film is a gentleman named Saul Bass. He is maybe unknown to you. He is not the Bass of Rankin and Bass, the terrifying holiday specials with stop motion puppets that still haunt me to this day. No, he was a title designer. You would probably remember him if you've ever seen Vertigo or Anatomy of a Murder or North by Northwest or Psycho. I'm sure you've seen. He did the title design for all that stuff. He was born in Brooklyn. And the son of Jewish immigrants and ended up getting married in 1938, to his first wife, Ruth Cooper. They have a couple of kids, over the next 8 years or so, but that was not to be the love of Saul Bass's life. He got his first real Hollywood gig after doing designs for print ads for movies like Death of a Salesman, and notably a movie called The Moon is Blue, which was directed by Otto Preminger. Now, Otto Preminger liked that design so much, he asked Saul Bass to do the poster for 1954's Carmen Jones, which is notable for being an all-black cast performance of the opera Carmen. And it was a big hit. And Preminger liked the poster so much that he asked Bass to do the opening credit sequence, and the rest, as they say, is history. He went on to do title sequences for Hitchcock, for Preminger, got a lot of attention for his work in The Man with the Golden Arm, which is a really fascinating movie about Frank Sinatra with a wicked heroin addiction. Clean burning propane. He's fantastic in the movie. You really ought to see if you never have. So, we kind of fast forward to 1961, and this is when Bass marries his second wife, Elaine Mekatura. Now, Elaine was born in New York also, and also to immigrant parents, and showed a really early aptitude for the arts. In fact, she, along with her four sisters, sang as a group called the Belmont Sisters in World War II, where they toured service clubs and they appeared on the radio and stuff like that. But Elaine was interested in pursuing a different kind of art altogether, and at the age of 18, she left all the singing behind and entered the world of New York fashion, where she did sketches for a lot of the big fashion houses. In 1947, she moves to California and finds herself working in design for Capitol Records. And then a position opens up under Saul Bass, who, you know, was doing title design work by that time. And to quote Elaine herself, she says, "I'd enjoyed the credits for the seven-year itch," and this is me parenthetically inserting, Seven-Year Itch is the movie where Marilyn Monroe's skirt blows up, that real famous picture that's from Seven-Year Itch. So Elaine says, "I had enjoyed the credits for the Seven-Year Itch very much, but the name Saul Bass didn't mean anything to me." But that would all change pretty swiftly. She got the job as Saul Bass's assistant, and then she began co-producing with him and then directing some of the sequences, and she became a true collaborator with Bass. In 1961, a year following their co-production for the title sequence for Spartacus, Saul Bass and Elaine were married. They received kind of a late career boon, actually, when Martin Scorsese asked the Basses to do Goodfellas. So they did the title design for that. And they went on to do that in Cape Fear and The Age of Innocence and Casino. And unfortunately, Casino was the final credit sequence that they ever produced, which was in 1995. So, you know, there was retirement and a golden age and all that stuff. But before all that, like, he had a tremendous career and is incredibly influential just for being the guy who designed titles for those incredible movies, right? So now we turn to his one feature film, and one wonders, hey, how come he never did another? Well, it's because the movie he directed was Phase 4, which is a strange, strange film. The director of photography on this thing is a guy named Dick Busch, which, aside from being kind of funny if you're an immature person like me, is also best known among our crowd, our people, as the guy who did a lot of cinematography for Hammer Productions, like one of my favorites, Twins of Evil, which I just adore that movie. It's so innocent, but at the same time, lewd. And there's something kind of charming about it to me. He also did Dracula AD 1972. He did The Legacy, The Philadelphia Experiment, Lair of the White Worm, for God's sakes. To note just a few, like, the guy's got a tremendous, tremendous resume. So, you know, you'll see his name pop up. If you're watching movies in the 70s and 80s, Dick Busch is probably shooting some of that. And then, to round out kind of our cast of characters here contributing to this film, I want to talk about the music a little bit. The music's real trippy. It's a lot of electronic sounds and that sort of thing. And it's credited to, Brian Gascoigne. His biggest feature besides Phase 4 would arguably be 1985's The Emerald Forest. Didn't do a lot of work, quite frankly. Now, there's a final montage sequence that we'll talk about that was not included in the original film. And the music for that was done by a guy named Stomu Yamashita. And that all got cut from the theatrical release. And then David Voorhouse and Desmond Briscoe are the two guys who composed a lot of the electronic music. And they released a soundtrack to this thing way back in 2015 on vinyl. So if you want a vinyl copy of Phase 4, the soundtrack, you can get that now thanks to Waxwork Records. So there's basically only three characters in the movie. There's Dr. Hubbs, as played by Nigel Davenport. Davenport has been in everything. He's, you know, one of those British actors, came up doing Shakespeare, probably best known for A Man for All Seasons, but he also had an early role, I think uncredited, in Peeping Tom. So he's been around. And here's a fascinating thing about Nigel Davenport. You can win a bar bet this way. Nigel Davenport read the lines of Hal in 2001 A Space Odyssey, but on set for the actors to respond to. And then once the film was shot, his voice was replaced with that of a guy named Douglas Rain. And unfortunately, Nigel Davenport left us in 2013 at the age of 85 with dozens of film and television appearances under his belt. He is joined in the film by an actor named Michael Murphy, another guy I'm almost positive you have seen, who plays a character named James Lesko, sort of the codebreaker, the game theorist. We'll get into it. So Michael Murphy started off as a Marine. Then he was a high school teacher and then decided, like, ah, screw all this. I want to be an actor. And he ended up falling into a troupe of actors that worked with, like, Woody Allen and Robert Altman in particular. And he was in MASH and Nashville and McCabe and Mrs. Miller and a bunch of Altman movies. But for his horror bona fides, you don't have to look any further than Count Yorga Vampire. And he also dipped back into the genre with Wes Craven's Shocker in the 1980s. And he has an impressive body of work. And he is also pretty good in everything. Like, Michael Murphy is kind of an unsung actor in a lot of ways. And I think it's because he has kind of not plain exactly, but very unremarkable features. He looks like a 70s leading man. And which brings us to our leading lady, which is Lynn Frederick, playing a character named Kendra Eldridge. Lynn Frederick is such a sad story, and one that I find really fascinating, as much as it is sad. So she appeared in about 20 films, but all from 1970 to 1979. And you may ask, hey, how come she only worked for 9 years as an actress? Well, at the tender age of 22, 2 years after she filmed Phase 4, she's 20 years old in this movie, Lynn Frederick married and became the last wife of Peter Sellers, who I'm sure you know from, you know, Dr. Strangelove and all the Clouseau films. I mean, one of the great comedic minds of all time, right? So she marries Peter Sellers. And the rumor is that they were in the process, or Sellers was in the process of cutting Lynn Frederick from his will when he died in 1980, the day before her 26th birthday, by the way. So they're married for about 4 years. And he drops dead day before her birthday. The will remained as is. Lynn Frederick inherits the bulk of Sellers' estate. But she never apparently recovers from his death. And there are reports that she attempted suicide several times in her remaining years and developed a fondness for the booze and how it made memories go away. She did remarry twice more, but both fairly brief marriages, one to interviewer David Frost, who you may know from the Frost-Nixon movies, and or just from David Frost. He's a famous guy. But none of them lasted. And in her waning days, the stepdaughter she had from her marriage to Seller saw her. I think it was Britt Eklund's daughter. Saw her and said, quote, Lynn was sitting in her kitchen dressed in a filthy caftan. She could hardly move. She was swigging vodka directly from a jug with a handle on the side. And not long after this visit, Lynn Frederick died at the tender age of 39. There were whispers that it was a suicide, but the autopsy revealed no direct cause of death beyond, you know, years of depression and alcohol abuse. A really tortured soul, apparently. When she died, she was cremated, and her ashes were mixed with those of Peter Sellers in a final internment. Very sad story, and if you see Phase 4, she has these almost ethereal elven features. You know, she's a very lovely young girl. I haven't seen a lot of her other work, but man, just the most heartbreaking of stories. So let's get back to the movie. Phase 4 is Saul Bass's only feature film, as we've said. But to appreciate this movie, you have to understand Saul Bass was a designer, right? He was an artist at heart, a visual artist at heart, and wanted to capture this idea of man versus nature, where man is not necessarily the protagonist. And in doing so, he calls upon the services of wildlife photographer Ken Middleham, who was known at this time for close-ups of insects in a movie that is also worth your time called The Hellstrom Chronicle, which examines the power and the implied threat of insect life on this planet. And he does these incredible super close-up shots of insects. And it's amazing. It's fascinating, just hypnotic to look at. And so Bass gets him because he wants that style employed for the shots of the ants. Because we're not dealing with giant ants here. They're just smart. And combining that with Bass's design aesthetic, these visuals are just impressive. Like, to this day, I've watched this movie a bunch recently, and every time I watch it, I come away from it thinking, I wish there were a better print, because this movie is so beautiful. So the movie was set in Arizona. All the exteriors, though, were actually shot in Kenya, and the interiors are shot at the venerable Pinewood Studios in England, and finally released unto the world in 1974. But what the hell is this movie about anyway, you may ask? Well, let's get to that. To kick this movie off, it's probably going to be best to let the movie explain itself for a minute.
That spring, we were all watching the events in space and wondering what the final effect would be. Astronomers argued over theory, while engineers got pretty excited about variables in magnetic fields. Mystics predicted earthquakes and the end of life as we knew it. When the effect came, it was almost unnoticed, because it happened to such a small and insignificant form of life. One biologist, an Englishman, Ernest Hubbs, saw something, got nervous, and started investigating. While I was playing around with number theory at the university, Hubbs was already onto something. Ordinary ants of different species were doing things ants don't do. Meeting, communicating, apparently making decisions. By summer, the rest of the world had moved on to other things. But Hubbs kept making notes while the threat grew.
Kinda trippy, right? Yeah, so that's how the movie kicks off, only you don't get the added benefit of all the visuals of cosmic soundscapes. So, I can't recommend this movie enough. Anyway, all right, so, yeah, ants are getting smart. They're talking to one another. They're not fighting with each other anymore. And from the beginning, you start seeing geometric shapes. I only mention this because it is so obviously an aesthetic for this film. Most of the time, humans represented in circles, but you see a lot of circles and squares, and it all is shapes and math. When we see the ants first, you know, as he's talking about, like, they were communicating, making decisions, it's like these close-up shots of honest-to-goodness real ants just kind of looking at each other and waving their antenna. It's all really cool. Like, all the insect cinematography in this is really something. So, the dubs that Lesko there, that's who you heard, was our pal Lesko, talking about Hubs being the guy investigating all this. Well, the next thing we get is a memo from Hubs, and he says the same thing, you know, like the ants are working together. We need to check this out, and we need to set up a station, a research station, to take care of this problem. And he recommends himself to be the head scientist, and then Lesko, whose work he knew as like a games theorist and mathematician, and that they be the two people to investigate this weird situation with ants in the desert. The local area has been deserted, and as we drive through, like, we're kind of following Lesko at the beginning of the movie, where he goes through this area, and most of the homes are deserted. It looks like people left in a hurry, like it's one of those things where it's a desert community, and clothes are still hanging on the clotheslines outside the houses, and toys spilled over in the yard and that kind of thing. Like, people had to get up and go. It's completely isolated until we start seeing these obelisks rising up from the desert, these giant towers that, you know, probably a solid like 30, 40 feet tall. And one of the first acts that we see, this is like Hubs and Lesko going to check out these towers. And one of the first things we see out of Hubs is that he's got this kind of iron spike, you know, not quite a crowbar, but he stabs it into the earth. And it, you know, obviously this is the era of echo horror films, and right off the bat we are presenting Hubs as a character who has no real regard or potentially a connection to the earth upon which he stands. He approaches it with violence, as we see he will do with most things. And they, as they're kind of strolling around and looking around, they find a sheep dead on their stroll, and then they see another, and then another. And they're walking through this kind of farmland area, and we see that Lesko notices that there are hard right angles to this one patch in the center of a bunch of matted down, like corn, I guess it is, wheat, something. And it's the first time this actually predates crop circles, the first reported crop circle, by about 2 years. But this is also exactly what a crop circle looks like, only it's a circle with a big square in the middle of it. And we start checking out the locals, of which there are only a few. It's the Eldridge family, including Kendra, Lynn Fredrickson. Poor, sad Lynn Fredrickson. And so they've got this farm, and they've built a moat of gasoline around their place. Lynn Fredrickson has a horse that she's riding around on. And we get a little time with Lynn's, I think, grandparents. Like, her parents aren't in the picture for some reason. It seems like a bad scene. Even her characters are kind of tragic, it turns out, with Lynn Fredrickson. So Hubs is telling him, like, hey, you got to get out of here. And they seem to know that something is up, as evidenced here in this clip.
I'd say they started pulling out 3-4 weeks ago, a couple of families at a time.
What else?
That's about the size of it. I guess there must have been some kind of infestation, but, well, I couldn't say for sure. Maybe the heat got too much for them.
There's a collapsed house down there.
Well, I wouldn't know about that. I didn't really get to know those people. They were city folk, mainly.
Tell me about the towers.
Don't know. Wasn't there. Of course, it's been a dry year. You know, we do get ants in dry years.
Hmm.
I talked to an entomologist up at the State Department of Agriculture one time. He said these things were cyclical.
They weren't talking about those ants.
Mildred, come on out here.
That's all right.
It isn't all right. These people will think I've got you chained up in there. These gentlemen are from the university. They're going to develop a new spray for those ants.
You know what I think.
You know, if she didn't have something to worry about, she wouldn't know what to do with herself.
I'm afraid you're going to have to leave for a few days.
So yeah, Hubs tells them to scoot, and now we are in phase 2, as the title tells us. So we see the facility where much of the film is going to take place finally, which is that like this circular geodesic kind of dome with these like pipes extending from it, radiating from it with little domes of their own. So again, with all the shapes, it, trust me, once you know that this movie is based on circles and squares and you're watching the film, you can't not see all the circles and squares littered throughout this movie. Again, a guy who was a design guy came from titles and knew these little visual cues would work, and they certainly do in this film. So after they click on a bunch of buttons, like it's a real 1970s kind of set, they start broadcasting kind of out to the ants. Lesko does. They're not getting any response, obviously. And then Hubs is on the horn, getting a little bit of static about the funding for their experiment, because it turns out like they're investigating ants, but as the intro suggested, the rest of the world had kind of moved on. Nobody is really clear if this is a real threat or even a thing, and it's really Hubs and his manic obsession with this that has led them out into the desert to study all this. And the funding folks are like, hey, have you thought about like maybe how to stir these ants up, get them to talk to you a little bit? And they're like, yeah, we've been thinking about that. Cut to a grenade launcher in Hubs's hands blowing the shit out of these ant constructed obelisks, these towers that he referred to, just blowing the hell out of them. And from above them, we can actually see like an ant looking down as they're destroying these obelisks. And once we're back inside the dome, we're checking out the chatter. You know, Lesko is listening in to all the sounds that the ants are making. And it shows a visualization of this weird parabola. Again, very trippy kind of visuals littered throughout this movie. And then we cut back to the Eldridge farm, where the ants have floated over the gasoline moat on sticks and whatnot because they're super smart ants, and they are eating the horse. And the family lights the fire moat. The grandpa, whoever he is, has to shoot the horse that the ants are eating. And meanwhile, like, we get these shots of the ants like nibbling on wood, and the house starts to fall apart. Like, the ants are just tearing the house apart as they attack this family. And a Jeep rolls in to save them. And so they're taken off. And meanwhile, like, we're cutting between that, and Lesko is trying to break down the basic commands of the ants and thinks that he understands, like, stop and go and things like that. So we're putting together a vocabulary. Which is another thing I love in movies. I got to tell you, anytime that somebody like Arrival is a great example of this, of like parsing out a foreign language or a different, like an alien language, or in this case, an ant language. I find that stuff fascinating, of like, what if you could communicate with someone whose consciousness you couldn't possibly understand? And anyway, it's fascinating. So that stuff's going on. And so the old truck that they're in, this 1930s era hoopty, it's no longer on fire, which is good. But then the wife sees an ant, like Mildred sees an ant in the old man's hair, and she starts like screwing with it and swatting at his head and screaming that they're everywhere. And then they end up having an accident, largely because the steering goes out on the truck as well. And the truck kind of hobbles into the area with the dome, the station, the research station. And they crash into the side of the dome, and Hubs hits them with what he calls the yellow, which is just this like pesticide, this super strength pesticide that coats everything. It's like spraying foam or something, except it lingers. And it covers both, you know, the truck and the ants in theory, and but also the people, also the Eldridges. We don't see Kendra here. Kendra like ran off to save the horse or something and blah, blah, blah. And even though the horse got shot and it was pointless. Sorry, Kendra, the horse died. But yeah, so this yellow shit is coating everything in the world around this dome, including the people who slowly kind of crystallize within it and die. But Hubs turns it off, and Lesko can't see the outside cameras and can't see that like people are in danger. He thinks that the loss of power and the very briefly and the shuttering of the station was somehow ant related. But Hubs turns off the yellow stuff a little early, and Lesko's like, "What are you doing?" And Hubs says, "Well, I want a few of them to go back and tell this story. You know, like they need to learn from this. They need to learn that we are, as a species, superior, that we can kill them anytime we want. And they need to carry that information back to the hive." So the next day they roll out, and they find the old man Eldridge. And Hubs is not really bothered by the fact that human beings have died in the course of this experiment. Lesko, on the other hand, is like, "Man, we killed somebody. Like, you know, we should take some responsibility. We need to let somebody know." And they find that their generator, or the generator for the car, had exploded because the ants had worked together to form a chain to essentially stop it up. And then they find this dude under a tarp, and as they're examining him, he's got like a closed fist, and they open his fist up, and there are holes, circular holes in his hand, and ants come out. And it's like, oh, they burrowed inside this dude to save themselves from the poison, which is pretty awesome. And then a cellar door opens nearby, and guess what, everybody? It's Kendra. So they, because she's alive, they silkwood her along with themselves back into the dome, under the dome, under the ant dome, perhaps. But they bring her inside because they're like, well, we can't leave her out there because that place is coated in poison. And so Hubs is kind of talking up their experiment, right? They're kind of explaining to Kendra what it is that they do. And he's saying, you know, these ants are like, they don't have individual consciousnesses. They're just like individual cells in a single body. And Lesko is petitioning for Hubs to get lifted out of there. But Hubs is like, "Eh, fuck that. We're good." So, in fact, let's catch a little bit of this right now.
When are we going to get her out of here?
That's going to be a little difficult, I'm afraid. Turn on the microphone, please.
Call in and have them send out a helicopter.
I'm afraid the bureaucrats will be rather unhappy to learn of our casualties. Now, mantises are at this end of the maze. The ants are at the other.
What are we going to do with the girl?
What is your concern with her?
She's in shock. We can't just... She's
Please,
a kid.
Don't shout. This is a problem that will have to be dealt with over the next few days until we're finished.
If you won't call the base, I will.
I'm very much afraid that that will end our mission.
Screw our mission.
So, right, Lesko wants to get out of there, or at least get Kendra out. And Hubs, not having it. So, and then Kendra strolls in, looks at their, you know, little lab set up with their sample ants that they harvested from the dude's hand outside the dome. And she freaks out. Like, these ants have killed her horse and stolen her family and all that stuff. So she just busts the place up. They yank her out of the room where they have, like, ants and mantises alike, as you heard in that clip. You know, now loose in the lab. And so they slam the door shut. Hubs hits this button and a bunch of gas goes in. And he says, wow, that should take care of it. And... So presumably we've killed all the ants and mantises, although we'll learn soon that that is not exactly the truth. Also, Hubs has been bitten by one of said ants, and Lesko notices it, and, you know, Hubs is kind of rubbing at it. Again, this will come back into play here in a moment. And then we have maybe my favorite sequence from this entire film, which is... ants these black ants that we've been seeing throughout the film go into this area coated by this yellow pesticide, and they'll take a piece and start carrying it, but they will inevitably die from the poison, and then another ant will pick up this bit of poison that they've dropped and keep carrying it, and they relay it like that back to the hive and the nest, and there they feed a little bit of the poison to the queen. And again, this is all like real ants, and you're seeing all this in super close-up photography. It's amazing. And so they feed this bit of poison to the queen, and then she begins laying these yellow eggs, producing yellow ants that are now resistant to this pesticide. Oh, it's so good. This sequence is so good. And even the music kind of trills and mourns as these ants die in the service of, hey, we've got to build a resistance to this. And it's so amazing. So back in the dome, Hubs is on the horn with command. And when they ask, he says, nope, we haven't seen any civilians here. And so he's a big fat liar. And Lesko is showing Hubs, you know, some of the visualization of the language. And Hubs lies and says, hey, I talked to command. There's a helicopter coming pretty soon. Well, that night, the ants then construct some more obelisks. Only these are fairly small, but they are angled towards the dome, the station. And they have a reflective surface. So as the sun rises, this light is reflected directly onto the dome. And the temperature starts rising inside. Now, they've got an air conditioning unit. But what becomes clear is that while they can survive the heat, their computers are not necessarily in the same boat. Because once it gets above 90 degrees, their computer system shuts off, which leaves them alive, but essentially impotent. Meanwhile, Lesko is telling Kendra, like, hey, everything's going to be cool. A helicopter's on the way. And in fact, here it is.
Good morning, James. As you can see, we're under siege. the hell's that?
Well, it's more than reflected sunlight. Our temperature's already up 5 degrees. And there's another interesting detail. How do you suppose those ants managed to build on a poison strip where they absolutely cannot live?
Did you say 5 degrees?
An hour and a half. And, of course, the sun's not yet at full strength. Now, watch this.
An hour and a half.
Oh, you really must watch this. This is fascinating. There. Beautiful adaptation, isn't it? We challenge with yellow chemistry. They respond with yellow creatures.
We're gonna fry in here.
Question. What do they want? What are their goals?
They have no goals.
Well, you saw how they disabled the truck.
Listen, Hubs, I came down here to get in a couple of weeks of science in the sun. I did not sign up for a war against a bunch of goddamn ants. And furthermore, why the hell did you leave the truck out there in the first place?
Bait.
So, yeah, Hubs has no intention of leaving the facility. And Lesko puts it together like, hey, you didn't actually call anyone, did you? And while this is going on, the ants that had escaped in the lab have formed a circle around one of the components on their communications board and fried it. So now the communication system is out and they're cut off in this dome with steadily rising temperatures. So Lesko hangs out with Kendra and is telling her like what's going on and what he's doing and what's happening with the ants. And he says, like, they're trying to fry us, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to bounce sound off of them. And if there's any range of sound that doesn't come back, that means that it's being absorbed by these constructions and we can use it to essentially blast them. And so that's what he does. He blasts these this sound wave out and starts crumbling these obelisks that are frying them from the outside. And so while Lesko is attacking the obelisks, the reflective ones that are burning them up, inside, a couple of the ants are trying to kind of dismantle or diffuse or destroy the air conditioning, which is what's keeping the temperature down in this place. And one of the mantises has gotten loose too. And one of the mantises is hunting an ant as it's trying to, you know, fry the AC. And then another ant sees the mantis and gets the mantis's attention, kind of, to get the mantis to come for it. But when the mantis does that, it slips on some coils, falls on another electrical component, which fries the air conditioning. So not only does the ant destroy the air conditioning, the ant does it in a really sneaky way, which is pretty great. So the mounds are crumbling outside. The obelisks are crumbling, and it's kind of a stalemate. Like, we've lost air conditioning, but also we've taken out some of the obelisks, but not all of them. So there's still heat to be absorbed by the dome and reflected onto it. But, you know, as night falls, obviously, the temperature goes down inside and the computers can be used again. And Lesko kind of wonders if they're not being allowed this time by the ants. Like, the ants, if they wanted to, like, the air conditioning is crippled. They can only use their computers so much, and during the day it's so hot they can barely do anything. It's a bad, bad scene. And Lesko is like, I think we might just be good old-fashioned screwed. So there is this amazing sequence that comes after this where there is essentially an ant funeral where the ants go collect all the bodies of the ants who have fallen in the assault on the dome, like the ones that were in the obelisk, and they're lined up and the ants kind of wail and mourn. It's, again, just this micro cinematography on display that is absolutely incredible. It's like the ants are giving a performance. You just have to see it. It's so good. So Lesko, in an attempt to, try to figure out a way out of this situation, starts sending a message to the ants at night. And in this case, it's just a square. He says, you know, mathematics is the universal language, and if there's an intelligence out there, I want them to know there's one in here too, and maybe we can start to talk. And we see Hubs has kind of a mutant arm now. After he got bit, it's all swollen and gross and deformed. And as a kid, the first time I saw this movie, I swear I thought he was going to turn into an ant. And which might have made the movie more awesome. It's not the way it plays out. It's just he's been poisoned by the ants. But still, what if he turned into an ant? Anyway, doesn't matter. So Kendra is sleeping. And an ant crawls onto the bed, gets under her clothes, and is just crawling along her skin. Again, more of this microphotography that's real cool. And her eyes open in time to see the ant staring at her. And she just says, please go away. And, I guess the ant does. So then we cut over to Hubs, who's feverish, just laying down in a cot, feverish, half out of his mind. Kendra tries to give him a little bit of water, and then he accuses her of colluding with ants, and then he sees an ant, like, scurrying along a shelf, and just loses his shit and starts tearing the place apart. After they get him settled down, finally, and back in his cot, Kendra goes to Lesko, who, by the way, is a vision in denim throughout this film. But so she's with Lesko, and she just says, please hold me. And so Lesko and Kendra are kind of a couple at this point, question mark. I mean, it seems creepy. She seems really young. And I know as an actress, she was only 20, but she looks about 16 in this movie. Anyway, so then phase three, y'all. We're in phase three. And Lesko, in a more reasonable Hubs, discuss, hey, what do these ants want? And Hubs says, hey, I bet if we could get to the queen, like all ants follow the orders of the queen, right? If we can find it, and Hubs thinks he can, then he can kill the queen, and Lesko can lock the tracker onto her voice. And then they see like a hamster, a little desert rodent of some kind outside, just scurrying around. They're like, hey, look at this cute little guy. And then, of course, it's immediately devoured by ants in time-lapse photography. And Hubs says, well, we do have the hard suits, meaning their environmental suits. And Lesko points out that they only have two, and there happen to be three of them now. The ants do send back a message later that night when the computer equipment is working. And it's a square with a circle inside the square, and there's a dot inside that circle, which leads Lesko, who is a game theorist and puzzle guy and that sort of thing, to question what this message might mean.
What does it mean? What the hell does it mean? A circle with a dot. Now I know how a rat feels in a maze. Rats in a maze. It's almost like a controlled experiment in which we are the subjects. Find out which rat is the smartest, the strongest. An intelligence test. Will be this place? And what does the dot represent? Could the dot be a person?
Yes, Lesko, it is a person. Or so Kendra believes when she overhears this. Kendra believes that because she was mean to the ants by smashing up their home, that, and also her encounter with the ant that crawled up her body and gave her the ant eye, the stink ant stink eye, stink bug eye. I don't know, something in there. That maybe they're after her, and that if she were to sacrifice herself, then Hubs and Lesko would be saved. Meanwhile, our good pal Hubs believes he has located the queen, leading him to another manic episode where he thinks that, hey, I can go out there and kill this queen. But Lesko is pretty quick to put a kibosh on this idea, because he's like, if you go out there, you're dead. And I figured out, by the way, what this message meant. They want you. And speaking to Hubs, that the ants would let everyone else go if they just give him Hubs, who, you know, of course, drew first blood by grenading the towers. And Kendra, while all this is going on, steps outside, because again, she thinks sacrificing herself is going to help everybody else. And she starts singing hymns, and you see these great shots of like ants popping out of the ground, like they've been hiding there waiting for somebody to step outside. And then we see him like crawling between her toes as she's walking. And then we just see her just kind of staggering off into the distance. And then Kendra is kind of gone. Hubs, it turns out, has no more grenades after the obelisk massacre. And so he's asking Lesko to help him get his boots on so he can go out and find the queen again. And Lesko says that he's crazy, that they'll send another message. And Hub says, well, look, if they want me, they're going to have me. And then Lesko finds a note from Kendra saying that they're free now, assumedly or mistakenly believing that it was she that the ants wanted all along. And Hubs then sneaks outside and is surprisingly not immediately attacked. Lesko follows him out and tries to stop him, but Hubs kind of gives him that drunk shove away and then ends up falling into a pit that has been camouflaged. So as soon as he steps on it, he falls down into it, and then the ants come. And it's not a terribly gory scene or anything like that. It's basically just a dude at the bottom of a hole while a bunch of ants are dumped on him. But it's still, you know, I really like this scene because of the, like, did the ants just dig one pit? Were they just lucky? And then granted, he's going towards the source of the queen, but do they know that? I don't know. Like, I wonder if there's more than one pit is what I'm saying. So, Hubs has been et by ants. Kendra is missing. Lesko is all by his lonesome. And he decides he's going to go through with Hubs' plan. And he's going to grab a hard suit and the blue shit, which is the upgrade to the yellow shit that they never use because they realize, oh, the ants will just do this. Do the same thing they did with the yellow stuff and become immune to this. And also, we don't want to pay for blue ants. So Lesko is like, all right, I've got my poison. I got nothing left to lose. Let's go do this thing.
I would still like to believe that given time, we could have come to an understanding. Some rational accommodation of interests, some agreement. But that's not the way it's going to be. I've made some calculations about their rate of expansion using their intelligence, their powers of organization, their network of communications, their poisons, their ability to adapt genetically. I believe that after this test run, they'll move rather quickly into desert areas, taking over the countryside first, then laying siege to towns and cities. I believe they will learn as they advance, anticipating our moves, and continue to stay a move ahead. We have only one chance. The counterattack suggested by Dr. Hubs. A direct assault on their queen.
Jesus, I wish it wasn't me.
So Lesko finds what he thinks is the queen's nest. It's just a big hole in the desert. By now, his hard suit has become cracked. He has to shed all of that. It's just him in his sweet, sweet denim jeans and a shirt. And he's got the poison with him, the blue shit. And he climbs down into this hole. And inside this hole, there is kind of a chamber with a circle of light. Again, more shapes. Circle of light pointing down into the center of this chamber. And as he's watching, the sand begins to shift and fingers emerge. And then he realizes that it's Kendra buried under the sand. And she rises, but she is looking to embrace him. And he goes to her and embraces her. And then there's these, again, very trippy visuals of like an ant eye and a circle of red going into Lesko's forehead and then his chest. And then he gives this monologue that is the original ending of the film. So, you know, again, all spoilers, but this is following a series of very weird shots, sometimes seeing ants, the way that the camera is positioned, looking larger than Lesko and Kendra. And anyway, I'll let him explain it. It's real weird.
We knew then we were being changed and made part of their world. We didn't know for what purpose, but we knew we would be told.
So yeah, there endeth phase four. At least that's the original ending. And as you might imagine, it's a strange ending to be sure. And we'll get into sort of the meaning behind it and so forth. But so the studio saw this ending and said, you know, there was the original ending is about 4-ish minutes of additional footage, which is available on YouTube, and I definitely recommend that you check it out. I watched it for the first time just a few days ago. I did not know there was an original ending to this film, and now that I've seen it, I certainly prefer it. It is definitely more thematically consistent with the rest of the film, and it's also incredibly bizarre. In fact, I'm just going to read my notes on this ending as they are written. And maybe that'll give you an idea of the surreal nature of the ending. So Kendra emerges from the sand, just like in the original ending. We've got the same swirling imagery, and then we're running. We're running on geometrical shapes, giant steps, a labyrinth of people wandering, existing in cubicles, waiting for instruction, a faceless man, a fish with woman legs dying in the sand. Like a hybridization ? Was my question there. A man buried in the sand with an ant coming out of his head, then the red circles going into Lesko's head, an open mouth with a circle inside that, mirrored bodies melding and fusing, always circles, an aria playing in the background, frogs, flowers blooming, a man superimposed with an eagle, set free to exist harmoniously with nature now. And then Kendra and Lesko staring up, an ant larger than them from the foreground, watching. The sun rises, and then we get the title, Phase 4. And Phase 4, presumably, is this final evolution of humanity. So, yeah, that is what happens in Phase 4. And now, one might ask, what the? Upon release, this movie got a mixed bag of reviews. Time called it, quote, a nightmare incarnate, which I tend to agree with. And Variety said the movie, quote, didn't get the bugs worked out before release. Very punny, Variety. Still, the following year, it picked up the Grand Prix Award at the International Festival of Science Fiction Films in Trieste, Italy. So this falls squarely into the realm of the echo horror films of the 70s, but there's something really unique about the construction of it and that it's more philosophically high-minded than most of those movies, which sort of end and begin with, be careful, people, because nature will come get you if you keep dumping nuclear waste into the bear cub mouths. Don't do that. And it's incredibly dreamlike, it's surreal, it's haunting. The most striking thing to me about this movie is that it's distinctly anti-human. While the human characters of the movie, you know, they do struggle to subvert this sudden evolution of the ants themselves are the ones who garner the most sympathy, especially in that funeral scene. And there's a gradual shift through the film from seeing the scientists and Kendra as the heroes of the film, struggling against their ant overlords, and the maniacal violence of Nigel Davenport's character Hubs, and the flailing survival attempts of Lesko and Kendra. Like, all that stuff, it becomes more and more desperate, but it also shows that they're not just in control, but are also making, especially with Hubs, decisions that are uniquely destructive. And that with the ants in control, only through that adaptation that humans make can they find a place in this realm of the ants. And so some of the criticism came from the fact that the performances in the film are largely kind of sterile, which is a result of Bass's self-confessed inability to direct actors. You know, his was an aesthetic eye, not a performance one. But that same sterility, I would argue, lends more weight to the notion that the humans in this film are the villains, not the ants who, like, mourn their dead and exhibit altruism and self-sacrifice. It's really the people in this movie that do terrible things, and especially in the case of Hub, someone who does not care about the life of other members of his own species. And ants are, in this film, like, hey, we're all in the same gang. We're on Team Ant, and it's Team Ant v. everyone. And much like aphids in the original ending of this movie, humans are sort of converted to like chattel, that they're a curiosity to the ants, and also, you know, the dominant species at by the end of the original film, as the original ending was envisioned. The ants have taken over the world, and human beings live in little ant colonies of people. It's crazy. Anyway, really good though. But so the movie was not a success, and I think you can attribute the lack of success to just this sort of effect, which is this like cerebral blend of sci-fi and horror that's as much concerned with whether humanity deserves the planet it rules over as it is with the killer ants. You know, the movie poster did no favors either, which it features like ants coming out of the guy's hand and a background with burning homes and people fleeing in terror. And all of that actually happens in the movie, but those are kind of blips on the radar of this film and not the majority of the runtime. So, you know, to kind of put a cap on the film's ending, it does feel abrupt in the theatrical release, and that's because it is. And after screening the movie, Paramount was like, hey, this is just too fucking weird. And we're not in the mood to send out a Revenge of Nature film with this 2001 style ending. And interestingly about that ending, it was discovered in 2012. It was found and restored, and the movie was screened for the first time in its entirety with its original ending at the Alamo Drafthouse just a few years ago, marking the first occasion that the actual vision of Saul Bass, the only film he ever directed, was ever seen. And if you joined us at the online screening, we're trying to do that with the show, is I'll put up a notice on the Facebook and say, hey, here's the movie for Horror Hangover, and come watch it with me, because I have to watch these movies a few times. The last time I watch it, I'm kind of making some notes about clips to pull, but it's fun to watch it with other people, so keep an eye out for that stuff. At any rate, the original ending is super weird, but it's also this kind of terrifying and sublime glimpse into a new world order as created by ants, and further emphasizes the idea that it's humanity and not the insect kingdom that belongs lower on the food chain, you know. Although the ants don't seem at the end of this movie to be concerned with just eating people, you know, in a lower minded film, that would be the case, that they were just killer ants that ate you. Like, there was a movie with Suzanne Summers, like a TV movie where ants got into a hotel. And that was the deal. Like, the ants just ate people, or killed them. And in this case, it's the ants are turning our species into a slave species. Which is way more terrifying, you know? So anyway, that's Phase 4. I highly recommend it for all the reasons that I've explained here. And if you do check it out, give me a yell. Let me know what you thought. You know, you can catch me over at the Legion Podcasts Facebook page, as well as just shoot me an email at bo@legionpodcasts.com. So thank you again for listening. Thank you again for being a subscriber to the Legion Podcasts podcast network. Speaking on behalf of all the other hosts, we sincerely appreciate it. And for myself, with this show still evolving in ways, but I think this is pretty close to what I sort of envision. But give me some feedback. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you like, and otherwise, we will be back in a month, much like a menstrual cycle. Horror Hangover will roll around once a month, and when it does, we'll have more weird movies with interesting stories behind them, or what I think are terribly interesting stories, and let's tip a 40 this fine evening to poor Lynn Fredrickson. So that's it. We'll see you next month. I think next month we're going to be doing another sci-fi horror film entitled Saturn III, starring Kirk Douglas, Farrah Fawcett, and Harvey Keitel. So we'll be back for that. And in the meantime, have a great week. Have great holidays. That's the end of the year. Have a very, very happy new year. Have fun celebrating the holidays, however you may celebrate it. And we'll see you in 2018. Bye, everyone.